Hello, I'm Jonathan Pryke, Research Fellow in the Melanesia Program here at the Lowy Institute. Last month, the Institute launched our latest Lowy Institute paper, The Embarrassed Colonialist, by Sean Dorney. Sean is a non-resident fellow here at the Lowy Institute. Previously, he was a journalist at the ABC, where he reported on the Pacific with a focus on PNG for over four decades. In this paper, Sean details the strengths and weaknesses of our nearest neighbour, provides a thorough justification for why now is the time to re-engage, and explains how to do that. With me today to discuss this paper is Sean Dorney. Sean, welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Sean, I want to get started by asking, why is Australia the embarrassed colonialist?
Well, look, I came up with the title when I was trying to work out just what is the relationship like. We governed Papua New Guinea, in Papua's case, for 74 years, and New Guinea's case for 60 plus. But that's hardly known in Australia at all. And although we throw a lot of money at Papua New Guinea in aid, there isn't a lot of general knowledge about it. And I was trying to work out, why is it that a country that we actually ruled for 60 plus years has almost disappeared from general consciousness? Originally, I suggested to Anthony Babalo at the Lowy Institute that we could almost regard PNG as the sort of illegitimate child that we gave birth to and we throw money at in the hope that it will never come home. So anyway, it just seems to me that whereas other countries, European powers especially, take some pride in the fact that they were colonial powers and they had colonial possessions, we seem to be a bit ambivalent about it. And it's for a country that began as a convict settlement and then evolved into a nation, and that we have people like Ned Kelly as our iconic figures, but the fact that we ruled over another people, I don't think fits very well into the Australian psyche. And we have been embarrassed by how we ran PNG. It didn't. Its current situation means that we look at it askance, and people think it's generally in Australia the attitude toward Papua New Guinea is that it's a complete basket case. Well, I don't think it is, and I think we should pay more attention to it.
Sean, it's often said that Australia is connected in some way to almost everything that is good in Papua New Guinea and almost everything that is bad in Papua New Guinea. True or not, it does serve as a reminder that Australia looms so much larger in PNG than PNG does here in Australia, even after 40 years of independence. Do you see Australia's importance to PNG continuing for the long term?
Yes, I do. And I think it's inevitable that Australia is going to have an important relationship with PNG. It's our nearest neighbour. It's right there on the border. And that differentiates us from a lot of other colonial powers, where they were in one part of the world and their colonial possessions were somewhere else. We're right next door to Papua New Guinea. So that is going to mean that, like it or not, our future is going to be tied up with Papua New Guinea. And that's why it's important, I think, for Australia to try and ensure that Papua New Guinea is a prosperous and well-run country, because it would be very dangerous to have an imploding country of 7 million people now, 7 plus million people. There are predictions that by 2050 there could be 30 million people in Papua New Guinea. So it's incumbent upon Australia, I think, to re-examine our relationship and take it more seriously. The fact that it's this whole colonial period just is totally absent from the Australian curriculum in schools is just bewildering to me. And I think that's another indication of this sort of embarrassment that we have about having tried to run another country and perhaps we didn't do it all that well. The point you make about the good things and the bad things, I mean, one of the problems Papua New Guinea has now is lawlessness and a difficulty of maintaining peace. Well, Australia wasn't all that successful, actually. We had a veneer of peace on PNG, because the thing I always say to people, you've got to understand that Papua New Guinea is 860 different language groups. It's 860 different groups trying to be pushed into an amalgamation as a nation. And it's not an easy place to run. We didn't find it all that easy to run, but it was far easier to run as a colonial autocratic ruler than it has been as a democratic country. And just one other point about everything good and everything bad. The police force we left behind at independence was totally inadequate for the task in a country like Papua New Guinea. And since independence. The police force has only increased by something like 30%, whereas the population has tripled. PNG has a tiny proportion of policemen to the population. It's, you know, it's ridiculously small. And I don't think, just on the eve of independence, the police force was undermanned anyway. And we only created a police department in the last few years before independence. Prior to that, it had just been an adjunct to the Native Administration Department. So there are things that we did in PNG that didn't work all that well, and we've now gone away. We're throwing money at it, but I think we should re-engage and try and work out with Papua New Guinea how we can tackle some of their more intractable problems.
That proximity you mentioned in that answer, I mean, it just makes the embarrassed nature of our relationship even more acute, and how you talk about how there are such strong relationships with other between colonial powers and their former colonies. Yeah. Through across the world. It's really interesting. You write in your paper that it's easy to focus on PNG's weaknesses as a country, and less often do people consider its strengths. What do you see as PNG's strengths, and why should Australia pay more attention to them?
It's not as regarded as much as strength now as when I wrote the paper because of the collapse in commodity prices. But Papua New Guinea's economy has done really, really well in the last 10 years or so. They've had constant economic growth, and I think even last year, when prices did start to fall, PNG's economic growth was still over 9%. So the fact that PNG has had a growing economy is one very positive thing. Another thing I say in the paper is that if you look around developing countries, a lot of them have had trouble with their militaries, whereas in Papua New Guinea there's been no effort ever by the military to get rid of the democratic government. And the fact that PNG is a democracy 40 years on, there have been regular five-year elections, some midterm changes of government, but there have never been huge civil disturbances in relation to changes of government. And the fact that the PNG military has never seen itself and still doesn't see itself as, you know, the government in reserve, I think is a very positive thing for PNG. Look, there are lots of other positives, potential positives. I mean, one is tourism. I think PNG has got fantastic tourism potential, but they've got to get that law and order situation under control too, so that the international image of Papua New Guinea is not what it is at the moment.
What about the state of the media in PNG? You made mention of that in the paper.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the fact that 40 years on from independence, the media now is stronger than it was at independence.
The domestic media, at least.
Domestic media, yeah. Well, the Australian media has completely lost interest. But within PNG, you've got two competing daily newspapers. You've got a weekly national newspaper. You've got a national broadcasting service that is now both radio and television. Of course, television did not exist in 75 in PNG. There are lots of radio stations now in PNG, and there's a very, very good online news service called PNG Loop. So one of the positives about PNG is the fact that the media, you know, maintains a look on the politics of the country, and it's thanks to the media that many of these corruption issues actually come out. And it's one of the perverse positives of PNG that so much corruption does get exposed. In many other countries, I don't think it does.
Do you think we're just at the start of more going in that direction with the, you know, the ICT boom in PNG and just the, you know, the spread of mobile telephony across the country?
One of the greatest things that's happened to Papua New Guinea is Digicel, this mobile phone operator that's owned by an Irishman but started off in the Caribbean, and it's now going, you know, mobile phone coverage of PNG is quite amazing. My wife is from Manus Island, nowhere near the capital, Orangau. They're halfway along the north coast of Manus in a place called Korapalik. And Pauline can, when she goes home, she can ring me from the beach on a mobile phone, which is just unbelievable 15, 20, even 10 years ago.
So, you know, given, you know, you're talking about the real challenges PNG faces in governing, I mean, the stitching together of this 800-plus different cultures and societies into a fabric of national identity and governance is incredibly challenging. Do you think we set too high expectations on the government of PNG? And I mean, in Australia, both as a country, but as a donor, as a partner, as a bilateral relationship?
Yeah, look, I think in Canberra there's, you know, constant exasperation about PNG. But I mean, one of the things I point out in the book is the expectations upon local members of parliament in Papua New Guinea are just astronomical. Everyone expects their local member to be able to contribute to their bride price payments, their funeral expenses, giving them gifts. You know, it's the expectations are just absolutely extraordinary. It would horrify any Australian politician. And one of the things Peter O'Neill has done to try and address that situation is that ever since independence, there have been certain amounts of money that have gone to members of parliament to spend in their own electorates. But in the last few years, that has now grown so that every member of parliament, in Australian dollar terms, gets about $7.5 million a year to spend. Now, there are regulations that a certain amount should be spent on health, a certain amount should be spent on education, and a certain amount on infrastructure and law and order and whatever. But the instances of that money not being spent as it should be are quite large, and the Auditor General has done some reports on that, and you know what they've found is that a lot of this money is not being spent very well, and that's one of the real governance issues that Papua New Guinea has got, because a lot of these members of parliament have set up almost rival public service in their own electorates to provide services and to spend this money, and it's almost a rival system to the normal government system. So that's one of the issues that PNG, I think, is got to struggle with, to work out what sort of a political system would be better than the current one, which brings so much pressure upon members of parliament who are regarded and regard themselves not as leaders, as representatives of their people, but as leaders who have to deliver.
Yeah, I think you touched on a really critical challenge or sea change that's happening in PNG is just this question of how they're going to govern themselves going forward, and the nature of democracy and the nature of governance in the country is an issue I think that we haven't really fully wrapped our thinking around.
I mean, it is interesting to me that while Australia has gone through, I think, five changes of Prime Minister, Papua New Guinea has only had two. You know, you talk about it, political instability. Well, lots of countries looking at Australia are scratching their heads about why we changed Prime Minister, you know, here every couple of years or so. Well, Papua New Guinea, since 2007, when Howard was the Prime Minister, Papua New Guinea's only had Sir Michael Somare and Peter O'Neill. So in some ways, you know, PNG is a little more politically stable than Australia.
So just moving on to more of the nuts and bolts of the paper, the conclusions, I want to just tease out, how do we convince more Australians that PNG matters to us, that PNG is more than just our largest aid recipient and host to an asylum detention centre?
Yeah, look, that's the question I keep asking myself too. How do you convince people? There are a certain group of people in Australia who are intensely interested. You know, Ian Kemish, a former High Commissioner, has described it as this small tribe of people who've had experience in PNG and it's got into their blood and they're really interested. But beyond that tribe, there is mass ignorance about PNG. Now, how do we go about convincing people that they should take PNG more seriously? Well, if you go back to the Second World War, you know, PNG played a pretty fundamental role in saving Australia from a Japanese invasion. So strategically, and this is what you'll hear in Canberra too, strategically amongst the defence experts, PNG is pretty important that PNG be stable and a resolute friend of Australia. If PNG develops more, if it has, say, 30 million people in the year 2050 and it is a prosperous country, then that's going to be very good for Australia because, you know, a bigger middle class will probably be spending more holidays in Australia, buying a lot more goods. Already Australia is the major trade partner with Papua New Guinea. So there are lots of reasons why we should, I think, embrace this former colony of ours rather than feel that we should be embarrassed.
So in a few specific suggestions you make in the paper include greater engagement around sport, the role of media, particularly Australian media in PNG, cultural connections between the two countries, and migration. Is there any one in particular of those four you want to talk more about?
Well, the thing that I think that there's a feeling in Canberra that all of a sudden 7 million Papua New Guineans are going to flood in to Australia if there's any easing of the visa issue. The visa issue is a real annoying issue from the PNG side. It is very difficult if you're a Papua New Guinean to get a visa to come to Australia. And the point I make in the book is, why is it that there are actually more Cook Islanders? In fact, I got this figure from a very good friend of mine, Jonathan, this is your research, but the number of Cook Islanders in Australia being higher than the number of Papua New Guineans is a really fascinating statistic when, as you said, PNG is 430 times the size of the Cook Islands in population terms, and PNG was our former colony, whereas the Cook Islands belonged to New Zealand. So there is that issue, I think, where Australia is sort of trying to keep all the Papua New Guineans out, but there are all these Polynesians coming in via New Zealand, and you know, where would Australian rugby league and rugby union be if we didn't have them?
So yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, we see this 7.5 million people as a risk to our way of life rather than opportunity through migration. I mean, this is a hugely vast sea of resources, of untapped resources of unskilled labour that we could be bringing in to help fill a lot of the supply restraints we have in the country.
Well, on that issue, the seasonal labour scheme is another one that's interesting as to why haven't there been more Papua New Guineans involved in this seasonal labour scheme. We bring in more Tongans, many, many, many more Tongans than Papua New Guineans to work in the seasonal labour program. So I found it really interesting. I went to the Torres Strait in late 2014 and toured with some customs people and police and PNG police, and we went hopping from both sides of the border because there are three Australian islands within stone's throwing distance of the PNG mainland. And this fear, I think, that there is in Australia that all the Papua New Guineans are desperate to come to Australia, well, that's not the situation once you get into those villages and talk to them. In fact, in those villages on the PNG side, they actually report illegal entry, people trying to come through to Australia. And under the treaty, they can come into Australia or come into those islands in Australia and trade and whatever, and they do. There are 50,000, I think, visits a year. But they all go back. It's not as if all of a sudden, you know, there's going to be this complete influx of Papua New Guineans into Australia. That's my view.
Sean, any final comments from you today on the paper?
Look, I've been delighted with the response it has had, but as I say on the Lowy Interpreter site, you know, in a way, a lot of the people who have responded sort of agree with me. So it's a bit of preaching to the converted. We've got to somehow jump that gap. And those people who know nothing about PNG, they're the ones who we've got to convince, I think, that the future of our relationship with Papua New Guinea is one of the keys to a good foreign policy for Australia.
Well, that's certainly something we all are trying to help achieve. I want to thank you personally for doing more than I think anyone else here at the Institute for helping broaden the interest in Papua New Guinea. For more on Sean's book, you can find our interpreter debate series on the Interpreter. You can find an ebook copy of the book from Amazon, and you can find the book also in select bookstores. It's a great and digestible piece of work and is a credit to Sean's long history and long relationship with Papua New Guinea. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much, Jonathan.